Welcome to 30 Minutes of VOA Learning English, the voice of America's information service for people learning English. Join us now for words and their stories and people in America, coming up after As It Is.
From VOA Learning English, this is As It Is Sunday. I'm Mario Ritter.
And I'm Anna Mateo. In the second half of today's show, we will hear how chimpanzees can experience similar emotional conditions to humans, even one called the midlife crisis.
But first, we hear how a deadly disease is killing not only humans in West Africa, but also gorillas. The Ebola virus has killed more than 1,000 people in West Africa, but it also threatens wildlife, like the severely endangered western lowland gorilla. VOA's Steve Barragona reports that the spread of Ebola has affected humans and animals. Anna Mateo tells us more.
One day in 1996, boys from a village in northern Gabon found a dead chimpanzee in the forest. They took it home, and the villagers prepared the animal for food. The World Health Organization says this started an Ebola outbreak that killed 21 people. Years later, writer David Quammen made a reporting trip to Gabon. He met two men from that village who were there during the Ebola outbreak. They said their families were not the only ones affected.
At the time Ebola was hitting their village, they saw something strange. Nearby in the forest, they saw a pile of 13 dead gorillas.
The killer? Ebola. Mr. Quammen says for the western lowland gorilla, Ebola has been devastating, extremely destructive. He spoke to VOA on Skype.
There has been an epidemic wave of death passing through gorilla populations across Central Africa, a wave of Ebola that has been killing them as well as occasionally killing humans.
Peter Walsh of the University of Cambridge in England studied gorillas in a Congolese wildlife protection area in the early 2000s. At that time, two Ebola outbreaks struck. 90% to 95% of the gorillas simply disappeared. Mr. Walsh says he and his team estimated that Ebola would destroy 45% of the population in just one generation. Mr. Walsh participated in writing a study of the situation of the western lowland gorilla. The study resulted in placement of the animal on the critically endangered list. For David Quammen, the story of the 13 dead gorillas outside the Gabon village shows how new infectious diseases are connecting humans and animals. Mr. Quammen wrote a book called Spillover, Animal Infections and the Next Human Pandemic. This book describes how these diseases jump or move from animals to people at an increasing rate. This is not new, but David Quammen says many new diseases, especially viruses, seem to be developing.
Something seems to be different because we've seen a lot of these new diseases, especially viral diseases, emerging over the last 5 or 6 decades. And that, of course, raises the question of why? What's different now?
Mr. Quammen says one reason is that the human population is going deeper and deeper into habitats or living areas, where humans are finding new creatures. In the world of diseases, contamination, spreading of germs, goes two ways. Peter Walsh says ecotourism, has helped protect the living areas of apes. But he says people taking those environmental trips are killing the apes they come to see. He says this happens because people bring their viruses with them. I'm Anna Mateo.
And I'm Mario Ritter. You are listening to As It Is Sunday.
Next, we hear about something else humans may share with primates, something known as a midlife crisis.
People in their 40s or 50s can experience a period in which they show unhappiness as they experience the effects of increasing age.
It seems primates may go through the same thing. Christopher Cruz and Kelly Jean Kelly bring us that story.
Research shows chimpanzees and orangutans may also be unhappy in the middle of their lives. The lead researchers are primate experts at the University of Edinburgh in Scotland. The research team questioned caretakers of more than 500 chimpanzees and orangutans at zoos in five countries, including the United States. The caretakers were asked if their apes enjoyed being with other apes and humans, how successful they were at reaching goals, and the emotional state of each ape. The animals were split into three groups: two groups of chimps in zoos, research centers, and a wildlife sanctuary, and a group of 172 orangutans in 39 zoos.
The study found the apes' level of happiness falls when they are about halfway through their lives, but it increases as they near old age. The researchers say there have been many reports over the years about humans becoming less happy as they reach middle age. They wanted to know if that was true only in humans because of culture or social conditions, or if it was biological and happened to other primates. In captivity, great apes can live to be 50 years old. The study found chimpanzees are least happy at about 27 years old, and orangutans at around 35. Researchers say the findings could help caretakers improve the quality of life for middle-aged apes by giving them extra attention or more activities.
The researchers say the temporary drop in happiness may be a result of changes in the brain. They suspect those changes are happening in both apes and humans. Lead researcher Alexander Weiss says knowing that both apes and humans become unhappy in midlife increases the number of possible explanations of the cause. He says knowing that a decrease in happiness is a natural and temporary part of life could make it easier for humans to deal with it.
And that is As It Is Sunday.
If you would like to share your thoughts with us about anything you heard today, please go to our website at learningenglish.voanews.com.
And join us again tomorrow for another As It Is.
Words and Their Stories is next, followed by People in America. You can read and listen to our programs and download MP3s at learningenglish.voanews.com. You can learn with us on Facebook, Twitter, and YouTube at VOA Learning English.
Thank you. Now, the VOA Special English Program, Words and Their Stories. Cats are the most popular pets among Americans, so it is not surprising that there are many expressions about cats. Some cats like to catch small birds, like canaries. If someone looks very proud or satisfied with himself, we say, "He looks like the cat that ate the canary." Sometimes a cat likes to play with a small animal it catches. So, if you play cat and mouse with someone, you change between different kinds of behavior when dealing with another person. For example, a child might offer something sweet to her little brother and then take it away when he reaches for it. A cat will often catch a small animal and present it to its owner. The saying, "That looks like something the cat dragged in," describes something in bad condition. Two old and funny expressions describe something that is the best or finest. Americans might say that something is the cat's meow and the cat's pajamas. Children might call a child who is easily frightened a fraidy cat or a scaredy cat. A copycat is someone who acts just like someone else or copies another person's work. A fat cat is a person with a lot of money. You may have known that cats spend most of their time sleeping. Sometimes people sleep for a short time during the day. This is called a catnap. If you tell about something that was supposed to be a secret, we say you let the cat out of the bag. If you are not able to speak or answer a question, someone might ask if the cat has got your tongue. Have you ever watched children in a classroom when their teacher leaves for a few minutes? When the cat's away, the mice will play, means people sometimes misbehave when there is no supervision. You may have heard this expression, "Curiosity killed the cat." This means being too concerned about things that are not your business might cause problems. If your home is very small, you might say there is not enough room to swing a cat, but you probably should not try this at home. If you ever had cats as pets, you know it is difficult to train them or to get them to do something. Cats are not like sheep or cows that can be moved in a group. So we say a difficult or impossible job is like herding cats. We leave you with a song from the musical play, Cats.
Oh, well, I never was there ever a cat so clever as magical.
Small, he is black from his ears to the tip of his tail. He can creep through the tiniest crack. He can walk on the narrowest rail. He can pick any card from the pack. He is equally cunning with dice. He is always deceiving you into believing that he's only hunting for mice.
This VOA Special English Program, Words and Their Stories, was written by Shelley Gullist. I'm Faith Lapidus.
You have seen it one moment, and then it is gone. You'll find it next.
Mm-hmm. I'm Shirley Griffith.
And I'm Ray Freeman. Every week, we tell about a person who was important in the history of the United States. This week, we tell about Helen Keller. She was blind and deaf, but she became a famous writer and teacher.
The name Helen Keller has had special meaning for millions of people in all parts of the world. She could not see or hear. Yet Helen Keller was able to do so much with her days and years. Her success gave others hope. Helen Keller was born June 27, 1880, in a small town in northern Alabama. Her father, Arthur Keller, was a captain in the Army of the South during the American Civil War. Her mother was his second wife. She was much younger than her husband. Helen was their first child. Until she was a year and one half old, Helen Keller was just like any other child. She was very active. She began walking and talking early. Then, 19 months after she was born, Helen became very sick. It was a strange sickness that made her completely blind and deaf. The doctor could not do anything for her. Her bright, happy world now was filled with silence and darkness.
From that time, until she was almost 7 years old, Helen could communicate only by making signs with her hands. But she learned how to be active in her silent, dark environment. The young child had strong desires. She knew what she wanted to do. No one could stop her from doing it. More and more, she wanted to communicate with others. Making simple signs with her hands was not enough. Something was ready to explode inside of her because she could not make people understand her. She screamed and struggled when her mother tried to control her.
When Helen was six, her father learned about a doctor in Baltimore, Maryland. The doctor had successfully treated people who were blind. Helen's parents took her on the train to Baltimore. But the doctor said he could do nothing to help Helen. He suggested the Kellers get a teacher for the blind who could teach Helen to communicate. A teacher arrived from the Perkins Institution for the Blind in Boston. Her name was Annie Sullivan. She herself had once been almost completely blind, but she had regained her sight. At Perkins, she had learned the newest methods of teaching the blind.
Annie Sullivan began by teaching Helen that everything had a name. The secret to the names was the letters that formed them. The job was long and difficult. Helen had to learn how to use her hands and fingers to speak for her. But she was not yet ready to learn. First, she had to be taught how to obey and how to control her anger. Miss Sullivan was quick to understand this. She wrote to friends in Boston about her experiences teaching Helen.
The first night I arrived, I gave Helen a doll. As she felt the doll with one hand, I slowly formed the letters D-O-L-L with my fingers in her other hand. Helen looked in wonder and surprise as she felt my hand. Then she formed the letters in my hand, just as I had done in hers. She was quick to learn, but she was also quick in anger. For 7 years, no one had taught her self-control. Instead of continuing to learn, she picked up the doll and threw it on the floor. She was this way in almost everything she did. Even at the table, while eating, she did exactly as she pleased. She even put her hands in our plates and ate our food. The second morning, I would not let her put her hand on my plate. The family became troubled and left the room. I closed the door and continued to eat. Helen was on the floor, kicking and screaming, and trying to pull the chair out from under me. This continued for half an hour or so. Then she got up from the floor and came to find out what I was doing. Suddenly she hit me. Every time she did this, I hit her hand. After a few minutes of this, she went to her place at the table and began to eat with her fingers. I gave her a spoon to eat with. She threw it on the floor. I forced her to get out of her chair to pick the spoon up. At last, after 2 hours, she sat down and ate like other people. I had to teach her to obey, but it was painful to her family to see their deaf and blind child punished. So I asked them to let me move with Helen into a small one-room house nearby. The first day Helen was away from her family, she kicked and screamed most of the time. That night, I could not make her get into bed. We struggled, but I held her down on the bed. Luckily, I was stronger than she. The next morning, I expected more of the same, but to my surprise, she was calm, even peaceful. 2 weeks later, she had become a gentle child. She was ready to learn. My job now was pleasant. Helen learned quickly. Now I could lead and shape her intelligence. We spent all day together. I formed words in her hand, the names of everything we touched. But she had no idea what the words meant. As time passed, she learned how to sew clothes and make things. Every day we visited the farm animals and searched for eggs in the chicken houses. All the time, I was busy forming letters and words in her hand with my fingers. Then one day, about a month after I arrived, we were walking outside. Something important happened. We heard someone pumping water. I put Helen's hand under the cool water and formed the word W-A-T-E-R in her other hand. W-A-T-E-R. W-A-T-E-R. I formed the word again and again in her hand. Helen looked straight up at the sky, as if a lost memory or thought of some kind was coming back to her. Suddenly, the whole mystery of language seemed clear to her. I could see that the word W-A-T-E-R meant something wonderful and cool that flowed over her hand. The word became alive for her. It awakened her spirit and gave it light and hope. She ran toward the house. I ran after her. One by one she touched things and asked their name. I told her. She went on asking for names and more names.
From that time on, Helen left the house each day, searching for things to learn. each new name brought new thoughts. Everything she touched seemed alive. One day, Helen remembered a doll she had broken. She searched everywhere for the pieces. She tried to put the pieces together, but could not. She understood what she had done and was not happy. Miss Sullivan taught Helen many things: to read and write and even to use a typewriter. But most important, she taught Helen how to think.
For the next 3 years, Helen learned more and more new words. All day, Miss Sullivan kept touching Helen's hand, spelling words that gave Helen a language. In time, Helen showed she could learn foreign languages. She learned Latin, Greek, French, and German. Helen was able to learn many things, not just languages. She was never willing to leave a problem unfinished, even difficult problems in mathematics. One time, Miss Sullivan suggested leaving a problem to solve until the next day. But Helen wanted to keep trying. She said, "I think it will make my mind stronger to do it now."
Helen traveled a lot with her family or alone with Miss Sullivan. In 1888, Helen, her mother, and Miss Sullivan went to Boston, Massachusetts. They visited the Perkins Institution, where Miss Sullivan had learned to teach. They stayed for most of the summer at the home of family friends near the Atlantic Ocean. In Helen's first experience with the ocean, she was caught by a wave and pulled under the water. Miss Sullivan rescued her. When Helen recovered, she demanded, "Who put salt in the water?"
3 years after Helen started to communicate with her hands, she began to learn to speak as other people did. She never forgot these days. Later in life, she wrote, "No deaf child can ever forget the excitement of his first word. Only one who is deaf can understand the loving way I talk to my dolls, to the stones, to birds and animals. Only the deaf can understand how I felt when my dog obeyed my spoken command." Those first days when Helen Keller developed the ability to talk were wonderful, but they proved to be just the beginning of her many successes.
You have been listening to the first part of the story of Helen Keller. It was written by Catherine Clark. Your narrators were Sarah Long, Ray Freeman, and Shirley Griffith. Listen again next week at this time to People in America, a program in special English on the Voice of America.